Star Wars without the drama of Luke and where he came from, who his father was, what his relationship to Leia was, all of these things, Star Wars would have meant nothing. It would have just been like a video game. But this philosophy overriding the whole thing about how you find yourself and who are you and all this stuff that everybody is yearning for and looking for, that's what people liked in Star Wars. That stuff is what had them keep coming back.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to episode 2 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I am a documentary filmmaker and photographer. And on this show, I interview the best storytellers in the world in all kinds of genres to learn about how they got to where they are today and to learn how they craft the impactful stories they tell. On this week's episode, we have Steve Starkey, an Academy Award-winning movie producer who has created some of my favorite movies of all time. Steve, who always teams up with director Robert Zemeckis, has produced films such as, okay, you ready for this? Allied, The Walk, Flight, The Polar Express, Castaway, Contact, and he won an Academy Award for Best Picture in 1995 for, any guesses which movie, 1995? Forrest Gump. As an associate producer and assistant editor, Steve also worked on Back to the Future, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and a couple of indie films called Star Wars Return of the Jedi and Empire Strikes Back. Not only is Steve an incredible filmmaker, but he's also one of the nicest people I know. Steve has been a close friend, close family friend for as long as I can remember, and he was gracious enough with his time to let me come do this interview with him at Skywalker Ranch, where he and his team are currently in post-production on a movie entitled Welcome to Marwen, starring Steve Carell. Interestingly, notable, Welcome to Marwen is a movie which I hope to earn an Academy Award for Best Extra. Yep, I'm an extra in that movie, thanks to Steve. Anyway, keep an eye out for that. But without further ado, I think it's time. Let's jump into my conversation with Steve Starkey. All right, let's get started.
Yeah.
Steve Starkey, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so maybe you can share with the listeners, where are we right now and what is happening here today?
Well, we're at Skywalker Sound in Marin County, California, and we are doing the final mix on our latest film called Welcome to Marwen,
okay,
which is due out in the holiday season this year. And so we're in the final phases of finishing the show, where we do a mix, the final mix, where you're blending the sounds, the sound effects and the music and the dialogue all together into one glorious soundtrack.
So how long of a process does sound mixing take? Is that like a week, a month?
No, it's about an 8-week process. Most of it's done, most of it is preparation, which both for, in the case of the sound effects, they have to record the special sounds that are in the movie that are unique. Most of the time they draw on recorded sounds, and meaning recorded sounds like a gunshot or, you know, a train whistle, things that exist in film libraries. But when you have unique sounds like the movement of dolls in a miniature world, you have to create these sounds, and they do it on what's called a Foley stage, where they, you know, they watch the movie and they create special sounds. So then what they do is they layer the entire movie with sound effects. Concurrent with that, you have the dialogue editor who goes through all the dialogue from the movie, cleans up the dialogue, and where dialogue is inaudible, like a, you know, a door slammed when someone said something, or the ambient noise in an environment while you're filming was too loud, you have to replace that dialogue. So we've already done that. Then they prepare the dialogue tracks, and then you score the music, the music in the movie, on a scoring stage. And that's done in advance. then all this comes together after about 5 or 6 weeks, and all these sounds are now ready to be mixed together. And we're now in that 2 week phase, roughly, of mixing all the sounds for the movie together, the sound effects, the dialogue, and the music.
So making sure all the levels are where they need to be.
Yeah,
and
you don't know, you know, you make decisions in every scene, whether or not this is a music dominant scene, you know, whether it's, you know, you should have louder sound effects, like if it's a gun battle or if it's a plane crash, or, you know, you just have to decide what's the driving force of the scene. Generally, it's dialogue, because the most important thing for people to hear are the words. You know, it's like a play. Then the music and the effects support the drama, which is, of course, what the people are saying, what they're doing. So that's the, you know, so, but it's all an artistic process. It's all very subjective, because movies are a subjective experience. They're not real. So everything that you do is heightening the emotion of the viewer and what you want them to feel at any given moment. It doesn't mean that they're hearing the music because the scene becomes music driven. It means that the music is driving their emotion. And if it works, they're not hearing the music. They're feeling where it's taking them. And so commonly, it's the drama of what the people are saying is what carries them along. And what they learn about the characters, and then learn about the story. But commonly, or in other cases, it could be just a sound effect or music that'll equally propel them through the story. Hmm. And so that's the art of the soundtrack.
Okay. And so who makes, who on the teams are making
these
those
decisions?
Yeah, like when to bring in music and
well,
that kind of stuff.
We have a team of mixers. Okay. We have a dialogue and effects and music mixer that sit at a board. And sometimes it's just one person who's mixing all three. But in our case, what's common in Hollywood is you have three mixers. And they make judgments together. They do a first pass, at least in our case. We leave a first... just a first attempt at the soundtrack to these three mixers with support, like myself, the film editor. We'll sit in the background, and when they want judgment calls, like, do you think that I came in with the music in the right place at this level, or do you think I should be, how do I play this scene? We're there to help them out. Mm-hmm. But anyway, ultimately, the judgment of what the soundtrack is in the hands of the director. He's the one who comes in, he listens to the way that you've laid it out, and then he'll then make changes as much as he wants. Some directors don't give the latitude to the creative team that are mixing.
Okay.
We do. I find that those directors are the least secure, which means they feel like unless they're in the room all the time, you know, somebody is could be making a mistake or damaging their film. In our case, we have the confidence that these artists not only know what they're doing, but can in fact bring a lot of creativity to the process you might not have thought of. And the worst thing that happens is you listen to it and don't like it, well then take it out.
Right.
But if you love it, it's something you never would have thought of, well, it just heightens what you were hoping for. It's just like no different than having an actor on a film set. I mean, cut them loose. You know, don't overpower them with direction, because these are actors, they're trained, and they're very creative people, and they'll bring something to the table that you may not have thought of. Mm. So it's always best to, I think, in all areas, whether it's a prop man, it's a cinematographer, it's an actor, it's a sound mixer, let them all explore their creativity and lay it out for you, having gotten an opening discussion from you about what the movie's about and how we think of this character, what the sound should be, but then let them have at it, let them interpret that.
Yeah.
Then come back and say, I loved what you did here, but you know what? I would really didn't like the sound of that. Can we just replace that? And then I love everything else is good. You know, so you can always come in and change it.
Of course.
But, you know, if you overshadow them all the time with too much direction, then you just, you know, you don't, you take away the spirit of all these people who are working with you.
Yeah. That goes to a question that I found myself wondering about, which is, as someone who has never worked with scripted movies, I'm wondering how much is like when I do documentary film, I literally don't know anything that's about to happen. And so it's kind of just filming a bunch of things, and then you kind of start to put the puzzle pieces together as it goes. Now here, when you are filming your movies, you have a script that's like you've chosen, you have all the specific shots that you want to get. And so I'm wondering about the interplay between kind of like improvisation and like letting things flow and going where things take you versus everything is laid out exactly as you have it planned. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, there are directors who rely entirely on improvisation, and the script is simply an outline. And which I've met, by the way, I'm when I've worked on documentaries, I do it a little differently than the way you described it. I more have a template for what I imagine the structure of the documentary is. Mm-hmm. Meaning, and it doesn't mean much more than that, because the interviews that you have are going to lead you in directions you couldn't have imagined, or the imagery you get is going to all of a sudden change the direction or make a point better than anything you could have said. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you start with a structure, basically, because otherwise it's so unwieldy, you don't know where this thing's going. I mean, it's okay to let it go where it might go differently anyway, but you got to come in like, you get your first interview subject, you got to know what to ask them.
Right.
You know, and
you have
the reason
idea.
You're asking them is because you have in the back of your mind, this is a piece about a guy who got, you know, who's debilitated. He sustained, this is now sort of a reference, say, to Marwin Call. Mm-hmm. He sustained this almost an assault that almost left him for dead. And through and in recovery as an artist, found a new form of expression for his pain in a new kind of artwork. And that artwork got discovered, and he now has become a somewhat well-known photographer of recreating tableaus. Mm-hmm. So now you at least go, okay, I'm going to go in there. Now I know how to start my interview with this guy. So what was your, you know, right, the documentary. So now we go into the feature world. We have a screenplay that when it works, should work dramatically exactly as it's done. And in other words, without any improvisation, it should structurally work. And what the people are saying is all critical. If for some reason, some people find that all you do is you just get them in a room, give them some opposing forces or something, say, okay, what you're after in this scene is this, and what you're after is this, go ahead and go for it, and just let the words come out and your feelings come out. It's a different kind of filmmaking. And some people do that. I mean, I think Woody Allen has done it sometime, Robert Altman has done it. Different filmmakers will use more improvisation. We don't use hardly any. We just literally, the screenplay, like for me, when I'm given that script with Bob, whenever I have a question about anything, if I'm helping a production designer design a set, if I'm looking for a location, I'm trying to cast a person as a character, anything I need to do, I look at the script. And it's very rare that I can't find the answer there. If you read the script carefully and it's well written, which I consider most of Bob's screenplay well written, you're going to find all the information you need. Improvisation will only take you away from the structure or the story that he tried to tell.
Okay.
Because he doesn't want that latitude. The words and the motivations are all so, you know, are so well laid out, mm-hmm. that it's not needed. It's just a different art form, the improvisational art form, in the structure of what we do.
Yeah.
Not to say that those kinds of films aren't great, because I do love them because there's a spontaneity and an energy that is completely unique to that. And but it's just not what we do.
Right. Interesting. So before we get too in-depth into kind of like the story elements of what you do, I want to get a little bit about your background and how you arrived to the role you have as a movie producer. I was thinking maybe we could start upon your graduation from Berkeley.
From college?
Yeah, and did you have a sense of what you wanted to do when you left college?
I didn't really. You know, everybody in Berkeley in those days, they were film nuts. You know, because at that time, you know, you're talking like the mid-70s, there are a lot of exciting movies being made both internationally and here in America. And so, you know, you're stung by those films, and they seem to have they were very stimulating. There was something that we're talking to, like, almost to the way the culture was thinking in this cinema. And it's not just like, say, the Easy Riders or the, you know, or the Five Easy Pieces or, you know, The Graduate or, you know, domestically or even a lot of more historic films. But internationally, if it was Bergman or Fellini or Antonioni, they were all talking about this existentialism and this, you know, searching for meaning in life. And sort of they were speaking the same language as we were. And so cinema was really vital at that time, not in the way that pulp cinema is today, which you're going to eat popcorn and just watch, you know, superheroes. This was like, this is how we were thinking and feeling. And so I kind of wanted to be immersed in that, I think, because I found it to be an art form that was talking to me. I didn't have a clue how a movie was made. Literally, I didn't. I didn't know how a camera worked. I didn't know, like, how you edit. I didn't know anything about the process. So I decided to apply to graduate school, and which I did in film. And then I thought, I'm going to go to L.A., and I'm just going to see if I can beat up a job.
Yeah.
And if I get the job, well, then it'll dictate, you know, the course of my life. But if not, I'll just go to graduate school and figure that out, right? So I go down there and I get one of these A to Z books, you know, like production companies A to Z. It lists all their addresses and phone numbers. And I just started with A.
Nice.
And started driving around L.A. and I'd knock on a door and say, you need an assistant.
I love that.
So in the meantime, I went to Universal Studios and I went to like the employment office, and I'm sitting in the employment office and I'm waiting, you know, for my turn to come up, and it was going to be a BS, you know, thing. And anyway, this one guy said, you know, if you really want to get on the lot, what you do is just go park in the back and just walk on as if you work here. And so a light went off. I went, that's what I'm going to do. So in the back of Universal in those days, they had the employee parking lot, and a big school bus would continually drive through the parking lot bringing employees onto the lot.
Okay.
There was no IDs or anything because everybody who parked there was an employee. And there was no gate, like anybody could just pull into the lot and park. So I parked, I went on, and I just started wandering the lot. I'd go onto sound stages and I'd see the sound man.
Yeah.
I'd go up and I'd be watching for a while and started talking with him, like, you know, how does somebody become a boom man? You know, how do you, you know, who's on your, and he said, oh, I have a boom man, I have this, and I have a cable guy. And I said, well, how do you get like a low, you know, how do you start? And he'd tell me, I'd say, how, well, where do I go to get that job, you know? And he'd say, well, you can go to the sound department here, you can go to the union, you know, that kind of thing. So I started talking to the camera department, sound, I went to the electricians, you know, the guys who did the lighting. And I started going around to different departments then at the studio. I mean, you know, that day I went, came back the next day, did the more. And I went to the electrical department. This tall guy named Shackelford, his son was a basketball player at UCLA. He was a Texan, tall Texan, like 6'6", skinny guy. Still remember this guy, and he had this Texan, this drawl. And he said, well, son, you come back here tomorrow, I might have something for you. I mean, this was the first time anyone in Hollywood had said to me, I might have a job for you.
Yeah.
So I was back there every day. Mm. And then he said, I call the local today, they might be out. And as soon as a local can't, the studio can't draw on the union, they're able to hire non-union employees called permits, which were people who were permitted to work without a union card. And then in 30 days, this is like a Taft-Hartley law, in 30 days, they have to allow you to join their union, and you must join the union.
Okay.
So I got my 30 days. You know, they put me on, my first show was called Baba Black Sheep. I showed up, I didn't have a clue about what to do. They sent me up on the scaffolding that overlooks the set. I was sent up there and they said, go to that baby junior, put a set of barn doors and put a double in it. I looked around, I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. So I did that and I stayed on that show for about a week and they laid me off. But I had 5 days in.
Right.
Then I kept calling Shackelford back every day.
The same guy who had said, same guy. I might have something for you.
And through Universal Studios, I got in my 30 days. And then after those 30 days, so then I worked as an electrician. I mean, I could tell you a lot of electrician stories, but but I worked for 30, you know, I worked for 2 years and my wife was working as pastry chef. We both decided that I didn't want to just do lighting was not the aspect of cinema that I wanted to be involved in.
Right, because you came to this industry because this stuff spoke to you.
Yeah.
Right?
We can, yo! You can answer the door.
Sorry. No worries.
They're ready to put up six.
Okay, they have it up?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I can either have them...
No, I'll be in there in 1 second.
We can pause it.
Yeah.
Want to just pause?
So, yeah. So, anyway...
We can just pause and go and we can come right back.
Yeah, so just where I'll leave off is moving up north. The idea of it.
Yeah, okay, all right. So we just came back from a sound mix. Let's get back into, I think we were, you were saying that you didn't want to be just an electrician, and I was saying how.
Yeah, I mean, set lighting is an art unto itself. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the art, you know, the beauty about working in cinema, in filmmaking, is there are many, many disciplines that make up, you know, the art form. Set, you know, lighting on the set is, you know, it's a beautiful art form and one, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I could feel. I wanted to do something else. I think I wanted to get, I didn't know exactly because I didn't know all the disciplines. You know, now I'd been on a film set for 2 years. I had seen how production worked and I was kind of more wanted to step back a little bit from being a specific, have a specific discipline and start to feel like I was learning more about the craft of cinema itself, not doing any one, you know, thing on the floor of production. So anyway, I left town and moved to Northern California for a variety of reasons. And so I had a touchstone, a friend who was working, had just finished work on Star Wars, who was in Northern California, and I had met him through some friends before I left. I went back to visit him. It turned out he was rapping at Lucasfilm. So I went up there, and he introduced me to a few of the people around the place, to Lucas's assistant and a few people that worked there. It was a small operation, only half a dozen people working at Lucasfilm then. And, you know, and I told them, they said, oh, this is Steve, he's just looking to do some kind of work up here, you know, and like a production assistant or whatever you might need. So I got a call like a week later saying if I would go down and they were moving an office into a new office building, could I manage just getting everything into the building kind of thing, the phones, the furniture, and all this stuff. It turned out, because I was helping the production assistant, that he was leaving. Mm. And I thought, oh, jeez, you know. So now I'm in this position that I could become the production assistant for Lucasfilm, which is, like I said, there's only like George, and his assistant, a receptionist, an accountant, and an assistant editor like Ben Burt, the sound designer. A few people there, Howie Hammer. Anyway, long story short, I got hired as George's production assistant, or the production assistant for Lucasfilm at that time. And while I was doing that job, I saw that the productions that came to Lucasfilm they finish their post-production, meaning their editing, scoring, you know, mixing, all of the of post-production was done there in Marin County at Lucasfilm. They would go away to shoot. They go to London for Star Wars, or they went elsewhere to do more American Graffiti. At the time, that was the show they were doing. So I started to think to myself, I should get into film editing, because then I can be living in Marin County and I can be working for these great filmmakers, like Coppola was doing Apocalypse Now, or Lucas doing, you know, Empire Strikes Back, or Phil Kaufman doing The Right Stuff, and Carol Ballard doing stuff, and Barwood Robbins, or all these guys that were doing great cinema out of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They didn't need to be down in LA to be doing this great, you know, the work I was trying to do. So one day, after working with George for a while, I don't know, 6 months or so, I said, is there any way I could get some apprenticeship in the editing room? So he said, okay. He came back to me. I guess he went and talked to them. He said, you can work Saturdays and after you finish work during the day here. Mm-hmm. So I started working at night and Saturdays in the editing room as an apprentice. Mm-hmm. And I was just doing what's called filing trims in those days. Now it's all electronic. Then they had film. And, you know, the crazy thing about More American Graffiti is it was shot in 16 millimeter and 35 millimeter and widescreen. There were two formats of 35 millimeter. Anyway.
But through all this,
I'm like learning the craft of film editing.
But now, you must have had like a goal in mind. Like, I want to go here.
I had no goal.
But you're doing these things that, like, you know, moving boxes, or you're putting in the hustle.
My goal was I wanted to learn what made film work. I never went to film school, so I never studied film in that sense. You know, I mean, I'd studied literature, and I appreciated cinema and film, but I'd never learned like the craft of storytelling and writing. And editing, in a sense, was the final rewrite. It was going to be my first introduction, or was my first introduction to writing with film or telling stories with cinema. As a doing lighting, you learned how to light a scene in film, but you didn't learn about the overall story that you're trying to tell. Going into film editing was the first time that world started to open up for me. Like, this is how the journey of a film is created.
In the editing room.
Well, the editing room opened the door up for me. In other words, now I'm starting to see, like as an electrician, I never even read a script on the film set. I just showed up and they give you the scene for the day, but I never like studied the screenplay, you know? And so this was my first introduction to all that. And now I was getting more and more excited about it. The more I was learning about editing, I thought, this is the whole thing. This is now where these movies are getting put together, you know? And, you know, come to learn many years later that what you write and what you think is the story changes entirely when it's filmed. And so thereby, the story that you thought you were telling changes in the editing room.
Can you give an example of maybe one of the movies that you've been on?
Yeah, well, let's see, this is going to be a broad stroke example, but okay, I worked on a film, Death Becomes Her. Death Becomes Her was about a drunk, a guy who was living with a woman. They weren't getting along. They were at each other's throats. And he found solace in a bar. And the only real person that he found in his life was this barmaid. And played by Tracy Ullman. And she was supposed to be like in this world of unreality of Beverly Hills, where there were a lot of phony people running around. The one place that he could find solace was the only real person was this person. So you go through the whole film with him growing further and further apart from these two crazy women. in his life. At the very end, he went off with this woman to Switzerland and they found peace and harmony.
Okay.
At the very end of the movie. It turned out that the movie started moving in a different direction where it was a crazy movie that it didn't resolve itself in the way that we thought. That wasn't a satisfying ending. With him going away, it just wasn't working for audiences.
So there's something about the script where you read the script
and it felt right. It felt like this is great, that because obviously, you know, he's trying to find, you know, some place to go and some place to find peace of mind and find some real people in this crazy world that he's living in. And he finds it in a strange place. And in the end, in fact, that's the place where he does end up with peace of mind. It turned out that wasn't the movie. The movie was too crazy and out there. It wasn't really about that. But on paper, it seemed okay. So we completely cut the ending off. Not only that, we cut the character out and he never went to the bar with this woman.
Oh, wow.
And we ended up ending it with a crazy story of these girls coming out of this church and falling down the stairs and breaking their head, you know. So it was a dark comedy that didn't end in the way we thought, and we only could see that when we put the movie together.
When you were editing.
That's like a blunt, big stroke change that got made in the editing room, mm-hmm. right? And we completely reshot the ending. Mm-hmm. There's many more subtle changes that we've made that you learn that what you write changes when you finally see it. And also when actors embody these characters. Usually less is more, which means the audience learns much more information than you thought you needed on the page to get them to understand about a character because of what actors can bring to those characters. Mm. So, I remember watching the very opening scene of Remains of the Day with Anthony Hopkins.
Okay.
And he plays this lonely butler in England, in this big mansion. And in the opening scene of the movie, just the way his expression showed you how he was going about his work, I completely understood him. Mm-hmm. Probably in the screenplay, it went on and on for the audience to understand, like, who is this guy? Let me tell you. These actors, these fine actors, you know, Meryl Streep in the beginning of that movie, The Bridges of Madison County, which maybe wasn't a wholly successful movie, but the opening scene, there's this music on the radio, and I remember how she wanted to hear, you know, just the difference between, how the distance between her and her family in this one scene in a kitchen. You got the whole thing. Who knows what the screenplay was?
Right.
But anyway, the point being that as soon as the audience sees images and sees the actors embody these characters, it sometimes changes everything that you thought you needed when you had it on the page. It's just the nature of cinema.
Yeah.
So.
So you started to get an appreciation for that. Once you were in the editing room.
When I'm in the editing room, and then, you know, and when I'm in the editing room, I see, well, I worked with a producer, his name was Frank Marshall, and I was, who is a producer for Steven Spielberg and became, along with his partner, his wife, they ran Spielberg's company, Amblin Entertainment. I was doing a documentary for them on the making of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and, Frank, you know, just because we would sit around editing, he said, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, what I'd really like to do someday is what you do. Because I liked that he had a hand in everything.
Yeah.
He was involved in the preparation of the movie, preparation of the screenplay and casting the movies and the production, post-production, the music, all these things that I had now been part of.
You got
but
a
now
little taste
overseeing
of everything.
Overseeing the whole thing, you get to be part of everybody's world. Mm-hmm. And So what happened is, so after that ended, I went down and interviewed, thinking I'm now in the film editing track. I went down and interviewed for some jobs as a film editor, one of which was at a TV show called Amazing Stories. And when I went to, which was a Spielberg-run TV anthology TV series, and when I interviewed, the producer of the series asked me if I might consider becoming, instead of a film editor, an associate producer. Associate producer in television, you're in charge of post-production and visual effects.
Okay.
I'd had all the experience because I worked on Star Wars movies. I'd worked in the editing room. I knew about... So I went to Frank, you know, who I mentioned I was hoping to, you know, become something like him as a producer. And he said, why don't you try it? You know, the worst that happens is you just don't do it again and just go back and pursue your editing career.
Right. You learn you don't like it and try something else.
But now this is the opportunity. If you want to project out now, let's project out a new track for you. Let's say you do this for a couple of years. Then what do you think? And I said, well, it'd be great if I could move from associate producer on a TV show to maybe an associate producer in film and work my way up to, in 5 years maybe, I'm a film producer. Mm-hmm. He said, okay, well, let's start that track. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time I actually projected out in my film career a place that I wanted to get to.
Okay.
Before then, I was just doing stuff to figure out, like, do I like this? Do I like that part? Do I want to do this? Now I was starting to see what I wanted to do, having now done this for, let's see, this was from 70, it started in 76 mm-hmm. through, now it's like 1983. Mm-hmm. So it took me 7 years of working in film as both doing electrical work and the lighting thing and going in production assistant and doing, you know, editing and apprenticing and assistant editing and finally editing. Now I'm associate producer before I even knew what I wanted to do in this world of cinema.
Right.
So that was like my education in a sense.
And do you feel like the fact that you had all those different jobs as you were learning and just trying to understand the craft of cinema, do you think that's given you, like, that's part of your strengths as a producer?
Is that completely.
Yeah.
No, because I can speak everyone's language. There isn't anybody on a shooting set, you know, that I can't understand what it is, what their problem is or what they need. Or I can just see what they're doing and see if there's a better way of what they're thinking of doing. If we go and we're planning to shoot, or we're, you know, planning a day's work, and I see, oh, you know, they're going to plan to put the generator here and then do this and then make a company move over to there. And I say, wait a second, why are we doing that? You know, and now I'm thinking back of things that I had done and say, wait a second, you don't need to do it that way. Or if I'm in the film editing room and I look at a scene and it's not working, I can actually make some kind of not just creative suggestion, which may be outlandish, but I can make a suggestion that I think can actually work, you know. Or I've been on the scoring stage. I was on the scoring stage for 44 episodes of Amazing Stories. I'd heard a lot of composers and a lot of music. If music is not working, I can make a suggestion of how I think the music could work a little better.
Yeah.
And all of that came from this accumulation of these 7 years of experience of different parts of the craft that when I finally could oversee it, you know, you bring that to the table. Mm-hmm. And then people respect you more and come to you more because you can offer insight and suggestions and help them. Not just be like, you know, here's old money bags, you know, coming down the road and, you know, uh-oh, here comes the boss. It's more like here's another associate, you know, someone they're working with.
So at this point,
so it's a different form of a producer because of all of this upbringing and what I'd done, you know, is what I brought to the party.
So going to, I mean, nowadays you've produced so many movies, so many amazing films, and you've seen so many scripts. I want to get kind of like granular on some story stuff. And so I'm wondering these days, like when you first see a script, what catches your eye? Or like what makes you think this could be a movie? Like something that you would want to spend year, 2 years on?
Well, you don't know. You know, there's no, I mean, I try, and usually I'm able to read a script fresh without thinking of the physical aspects of the movie, of, you know, what's to come. In some cases, in a few cases, the screenplay is so spectacular that I can't, I'm right away thinking, how the hell am I going to do that? Mm-hmm. And then I stop the process of this fresh, like reading it just like a story, you know, a story. But
and there's, what's one that you had that experience with?
Like Contact.
Contact?
Yeah, the very opening image was, you know, it started with this this shot where you started, it was like one of these micro shots on the planet Earth, and you went all the way out to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, further and further and further and further away from the planet. And while you were traveling, the sounds from the planet started going back in time because you were catching up with sounds as you moved away from Earth, and sound was traveling away from Earth. You as the camera were catching up to sounds that emanated from the Earth 10, 15, 100 years ago, where you were starting to hear old radio shows. And then eventually it went to silence because the sounds from Earth hadn't made it that far out in the galaxy even yet, right? So you go all the way like that, and eventually you go through this beautiful nebula out in the middle of space that you've never seen before, and you keep coming out, and in fact, you pull out of the eyeball of a little girl looking in a telescope. I put the script down and said, how in the hell are we going to do that shot? It was one shot.
But you had just started reading.
I just started reading. I was like on page 2.
And did that mean you were already like interested in the...
No, I was fascinated, but yeah. The mechanics of the cinema of it took over for a moment. Mm-hmm. Where I'm just giving an example of how something physical in it, just because I can't help myself, because when I'm reading, I probably read differently than someone who just reads a play. I read things quite visually. I don't just read, when I'm reading a screenplay, I'm not just reading the words, although sometimes I drift into the words, and sometimes I drift out into seeing what I'm reading. It's a little different experience than, if I read a book, I rarely do that. Mm-hmm. When I read a book, I'm just reading it, and I kind of picture it, maybe emotionally, but it's not quite the same. In cinema, I'm seeing it more cinematically as I read it often, mm-hmm. sometimes not. But usually, I'm able to just read it through and just feel the emotion just like anyone who isn't involved in cinema at all. Just like watching a movie. I just get and if it's working, I'm just flipping pages and just trying to see where this thing is taking me. And another thing, when you're reading a script, it's very articulate about what people are wearing, what the rooms look like, where the setting is, you know, so all these things are helping you along, in a sense, forcing you to visualize all this. Mm-hmm. You know, in books, sometimes they don't give you that kind of help. They unfold over pages and pages and pages, where eventually everything in the book will inform you, and then you'll start to piece it together somehow. In film, it's when it's well written is very specific.
Okay.
And you do start to see the world clearly. Even though I'm seeing that, it doesn't take away from me emotionally reading it. You know, if I'm reading Forrest Gump and Bubba, his best friend, dies, I kind of start crying. I don't like think about where am I going to shoot this Vietnam sequence where Bubba's over and he's bleeding. I just don't go there.
Yeah.
I read it.
Right.
You know, I just read it and I feel it. And at the end of the experience of reading the script, to answer the question, if the script is working, you feel the emotion that you eventually do feel watching it on the big screen. You know, that someone who didn't read the script. I mean, in other words, I don't get the pleasure of seeing Forrest Gump for the first time in a movie theater. my first time is reading the screenplay. Usually, if the script's working, we'll share the same emotion. Even though you didn't get to read it, I did, but they both, if the script works, it's the same feeling.
So even though...
Then at that point, I know that this works. That doesn't mean that it's going to become a successful film and that people are going to want to see that. You know, there's probably been hundreds of fantastic books that have never been read by more than a dozen people that are better than books that have been read by millions. You know, it's just the way things are, you know, in the world of marketing and exposure, whatever it is. So, but I've really felt like there's this combination of trying to get to the truth of these stories and the emotions of these characters, and at the same time, provide a great spectacle that people enjoy when they go to movies. So there's always this blend. You know, if it's all pure spectacle, then that's not a movie that anybody, you know, Star Wars without the drama of Luke and where he came from, who his father was, what his relationship to Leia was, all of these things, Star Wars would have meant nothing. It would have just been like a video game. But this philosophy overriding the whole thing about how you find yourself and who are you and all this stuff that everybody is yearning for and looking for, that's what people liked in Star Wars. That stuff is what had them keep coming back. It wasn't just like looking at spaceships. You know, and so it was so it's an interesting thing where cinema, you set these great dramatic stories in a place, you know, in these places like outer space, like in a Star Wars, but really the core of it is this, you know, is a story. So I think that, you know, the great movies that of the type that I've been working on, which are say the Spielberg, Lucas, Zemeckis stories, are trying to capture the heart, you know. Like in E.T. I mean, it's not just a simple alien story, you know. Those movies work because of the emotions in the story of these characters in the, you know, in the movie. And I think when you blend both, where people get to enjoy this grandeur of cinema that you see in no other way and get great storytelling, well, now you've, you know, I think you've really, rather than, you know, at the end of the day, I fell into these. You know, I was talking initially, I was really interested in the new cinema coming out of Europe, Fellini and, you know, and Antonioni and Bergman. There are no special effects in any of those guys' movies. I loved them. But then I fell into this genre, this type of American filmmaking, which I think has found a great place in the, you know, the canon of film cinema, you know.
So I mean, your movies are so different from each other. And just thinking about going from script to actually filming and creating the movie, obviously you've done films that are completely live action. You've done films that are completely motion capture animation, films that have a mix of both. So how do you go from reading that script and thinking about the emotions and the characters and what the core of the story is? And how do you move from there to figuring out what's the best way to capture that on screen?
Well, it's a process, you know. Right now we're doing a movie about a guy who is recovering. He's an assault victim. During the course of his recovery, he builds a miniature village in his backyard. And he inhabits the village with avatars or dolls of people who surround him in his life, and mostly the people who've nurtured him to recovery and have helped him and consoled him are women. So basically, he creates a world where there's this one guy who's constantly under attack by these Nazis, representing these people that assaulted him, and always protected by these women, right, in this town. In the way we tell the story, we go into the town, and when we go in there and live life in that town where there's a Nazi attack, the dolls come to life. And when you're watching it on the big screen, the dolls are full scale. Like they're living, breathing, full scale dolls. Okay, so now you're saying, how do we do that? So when we're in the real life part of the movie, meaning when we're with our real life character and he's going through the movie, he takes a journey in the course of the story, we see this miniature in the backyard and we see the little dolls, these little 12-inch dolls. It's a 1/6 scale village. Now when we go into it, how do we replicate that on the big screen? Well, the first idea I thought of was you build the town, then you construct a miniature town that is full scale, and all the actors that play the characters in real life will come in and we'll make them up as dolls, and they'll all run around and do the action scenes as dolls. Well, we started to do a test, and the test was showing what the dolls looked like as dolls. So we put makeup on the Steve Carell and on an actress, one of the dolls who's in the movie. And so I said, so do you like the look of the dolls? You know, asking Bob, do you like the look of the dolls? He said, not really. We're gonna have to give them a doll sheen. And we have to add like doll joints.
Okay.
Right? I'm going, we're adding doll sheen and joints. I said, this ain't going to be done live action. What was dawning on me, because we'd done motion capture before, was these people aren't real. We have to create digital dolls and let the actors give them their performance and then immerse them into a digital world and never build anything over scale at all. So the process of figuring out a movie is, how do you get to what you see and what you want that world to look like in the easiest way? This is an extreme example, this doll thing. You know, in a simpler example is, you know, you read a story and it takes place, you know, like say a Forrest Gump or something, and it takes place in the South, and you know, you have to go to Vietnam, you know, there's shrimping, you know, eventually, you know, you go to Washington, D.C., so there's all this stuff in that you're reading, and you start breaking it down. I mean, I'm just sitting there by myself with Bob, and now I'm just breaking the script down, and I break it down in chunks, like, okay, we got a D's, we have this section, so. Well, the core of this thing is in the South. So the first thing we have to find is, where is Forrest from? Mm-hmm. So I hired a designer, and then we start brainstorming all the different elements of the movie together. Okay, we have to get the South. He does have a town. We got the South. We got to find that iconic South, which is his house. At first we thought it was the town, but then we realized it really wasn't the town at all. It was his house.
Right.
That's home.
Right.
Now we're in the South. I don't want to travel to Southeast Asia. And I'm not going to go to Louisiana to do the shrimping. I want to stay in one hub for economy, for time and money.
Yeah.
So we started scouting. We found his house. And from there, we said, can we travel within an hour of this place in Beaufort, South Carolina, and find shrimping and find a place to do the Mekong Delta? Which it turned out we could.
More scenes, yeah.
There was a plantation that looked just like Vietnam.
Wow.
You know, and then for when he arrives, you know, there was another island that it could all be, and it wasn't even fakery. Mm-hmm. We were shooting it live action as if we were in Vietnam. We had Dale Dye, who was a decorated Vietnam veteran. He came in and he said, this scared me. I thought I was back in Vietnam.
Wow.
I mean, he said, don't even think about it. This is real, you know. So same with shrimping. We found out there's a huge shrimping industry in South Carolina right near Beaufort. There's boats. There's professionals. So we could hire and do all that. And so it turned out we could use it as a hub. And then so that's how the sort of the shape of a movie comes together, is finding out what the most important element is, where you go to do that, and then how you can surround it. And then there's obvious things. You have to go to D.C. because D.C. is D.C., you know, Washington, D.C., if you're going to stage the things there. And then we came back to Los Angeles when we built things on stage. But so, it, you know, it goes from this stage of first feeling the script, finding out, like, you know, what's the most important visual aspect of it and where you're going to house yourself. And then, you know, we are in an industry of economics, you know, so then weighing in on your decision is the economy of making films. Like, how much does it cost to go there versus there? And, you know, can we find stages there? Can we build this there? Should we do this on stage, on location? All that starts factoring in. It becomes a very complicated puzzle.
And do you feel like the economics of it, or the financial side, does that ever limit you to where you say, like, actually, you know what, I don't know if we have the budget to go into the doll world and make this?
Completely it does. The budget is always dictating what you can do. In some cases, it feels like it's destroying the vision of the movie. In other cases, it backs you in a corner where you come up with a better idea. So it depends, you know. And then also you find out, you know, by budgetary constraints, you know, like a simple example, say, would be in The Walk. Originally, in the real story, Philippe Petit, you know, we were basing this heist, this high wire act in the movie based on the reality of what Philippe Petit did. And what he did is he took an elevator up, it got him up to a certain level of the World Trade Center. Then he had to go up three different floors, and drama ensued on each floor before he made it to the rooftop.
Where he walked on.
The budget told us that we couldn't afford to build three floors. He was going to get up to a floor, drama, and he was going to get to the roof. But you could put all the drama on one floor or on the roof. Mm-hmm. And in fact, cinematically, it was better. Because then the audience, first of all, their geography wasn't thrown off. It's like, where am I? What floor am I on? And also, building each floor costs money. But the less you build, right? So for the economy of the storytelling or the filmmaking and the economy in terms of the budget, it improved the movie by having to scale back, you know, the reality of what happened. And but we didn't take away any of the drama because we could put it in different places.
Yeah.
It's just an example of, you know, how the money constraints, you know, encroach on you. And in some cases, you know, it works to your benefit. Mm-hmm. It actually improved the movie, I think, because, you know, those two reasons.
So you mentioned how when you go from script to starting to film this, things inevitably change, and especially when you're giving it to actors. So I'm a big Denzel fan and loved the movie Flight, which came out a couple years ago. And I'm wondering, maybe if we can use that as an example, how did the story, if at all, in your vision of the story of Flight, change when you suddenly handed this role to Denzel Washington? And maybe you can give, for listeners who've never seen that movie, just a quick synopsis of what the movie is.
Yeah, essentially, the movie is about an alcoholic airplane pilot who actually we see doing what he routinely does, drinks before he commandeers an aircraft with however many passengers from point A to point B. And there's mechanical failure on the plane, and he, as this drunk pilot, is able to navigate this plane to safety. It's revealed that he was drunk when he was piloting the plane. But he was able to get powerful enough attorneys behind him that he was going to be able to clear himself of these charges of being drunk while piloting the plane, which would then strip him of his license to fly and his career, and could have even, you know, been charged. So presented with this moral dilemma, as if you were given a get out of jail free card, but have to live the rest of your life free as a guilty person, would you take it? And that's a decision for everybody watching the movie has to make, in a sense, along with this main character. And he decides he doesn't want it, and he's going to suffer the consequences of his actions, which is the first time he's done it in his life, because as a drunk, he never acknowledged or suffered the consequences of his actions. He only just left a swath of, you know, of damage behind him with his family, with his friends, with his personal life. He was a disaster. He never took responsibility for anything. And this is the very first time in his life that he did. He'd had enough. So that was the movie, basically. So when Denzel took on the role, I mean, this is one powerful figure to embody this whole notion, because, you know, first of all, he's probably one of the greatest living actors, I think, and he's just such a powerful actor, and he's such a steadfast individualist. Particularly as a drunk, he's not taking anything from anybody. He's charting his own course. He doesn't think he's guilty of anything. What do you mean? I commandeered this aircraft to safety. What the hell's your problem? Well, our problem is you were drunk when you did it. You know, that kind of thing. And he said, well, you know, and he just gets pissed off. He doesn't accept any of that. And he keeps pushing people away and all responsibility, you know. But he's so powerful that I think the power of his recovery or his willingness to accept this responsibility is even that much more. Because this guy, I mean, he's hateful in what he's doing to people in the movie, mm-hmm. you know. And he was just so strong that I think it elevated the material to a level I couldn't have imagined, mm-hmm. even though you felt it in the script.
Yeah, but
when it was embodied by Denzel, it just took it to a whole new level, mm-hmm. you know.
Is there a lot of give and take with actors like Denzel or actresses that you've been working with who are at the top of the game and they have a vision, you have a slightly different vision, and that collaboration to decide what's going to happen?
That usually is, in our case, usually we do these what are called table reads, or in some other cases they call rehearsals. And often, when presented with the screenplay, you hire the actor. Usually, before you hire the actor, you meet and say, so this is how I see this character. You know, I see him like this and then that. And then he does this is where he changes, and he's, you know, this is how we play this scene. And you can get a feeling like, are we on the same page? Or are we like seeing two different movies here, you know? Then when you go to the table read, let's just say you felt that your principal cast understood the movie you're trying to make. Let's just now take it to the next level, and you cast these people. Now you go to a rehearsal, or what we commonly do call the table read, which is everybody's around a table and they're all reading their parts, right? And then you work out in the scene what the scene's about and who's taking charge of the scene and how you play the scene. If there's any questions, like, why am I saying that now? Doesn't she think that, you know, and whatever it might be, it comes out. And so you flush it out and rewrite it. If the actor brings up a good point, they say, wait, the way I see it, I just did this and did that. Why would I do this now? They say, well, then let's cut that out. Why don't we have it that you only do, you know?
Right.
We try to work that out so when you hit the floor and the money is being spent, the actor doesn't walk in from his makeup trailer and says, why the hell am I saying that?
Gotcha.
Now you got all the crew, you're spending $150,000 on the day, and they're all standing around while Denzel Washington is standing on the set going, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
It never happened with us.
So they
because
come to
he came to the table read with questions.
Yeah.
And he worked it out, and he and Bob worked it out. Mm-hmm. So when he walked in every day to work, he walked right into the set and went to work. He didn't even say good morning. He was ready to rock. Mm-hmm. You know, he was already in the space, ready to do the scene. Mm-hmm. All actors are different.
Right.
You know, we've never had an actor who, like, came in and just said, "I'm not doing that," you know, because we work it out mm-hmm. in a head. I think it would be a disaster to just give the script to all these artists who are working out their character.
Yeah.
You know, they're working out, who am I? Mm-hmm. And then just have a free-for-all on the set every day. I don't know how you get work done, because you'd just be constantly talking about their character and why, and you know how they're feeling, and you're going, Jesus Christ, can't I just shoot the scene? You
know? Yeah.
But a lot of people work that way. Mm-hmm. They like the energy and the surprise that comes from these characters not really having worked it all out. Different whole, different tack than what we do.
And then at the end of shooting, at the end of this whole sound mixing process that we're around today in editing, I'm wondering, like, when you put out these movies, what type of feedback is the most meaningful to you?
Well, if I screen it for the first time, let's just say to the uninitiated, you know, cold audience, never seen the movie, there's clear emotional peaks and valleys that you go through in watching, you know, a piece of watching a movie, and you can feel that in an audience. You can feel when it's funny. You can feel their you can feel when they're holding their breath, when they're uncomfortable, when they're bored, when you can feel this. So the best thing we can do is, once it's in an intelligible form, edited in a form with temporary music in place and enough so the audience can understand what they're seeing. You know, we do a lot of movies where there's special effects and they can't understand what they're seeing. So at the point they can, then you go and screen it, and important information will come out of the screening that informs how you've edited the movie. And you might then make changes. So that's the most important thing you get, is, are the jokes working? Are the dramatic moments working? Who are they seem to be sympathetic with while they're watching? You know, is it dragging? In other words, they got ahead of it sooner than you thought they would, so you don't know any longer need that scene that further explains something you thought you needed to hammer out so they understood.
Right.
You may just be able to take that out and speed up the movie, and they are still with it. You learn that stuff and further edit, you know, to streamline the movie. Yeah. A lot of people probably either don't like the process. Maybe they think they're making the movie for themselves and not for an audience. You know, we feel like we are making the movie for an audience, you know, to enjoy the cinematic, you know, experience that we've tried to put together, the story we tried to tell, you know. And so we find it invaluable to get an audience reaction. We don't necessarily try to get them to pinpoint in words what they think, which a lot of people trust, because a lot of people, they don't know how to articulate what's bothering them. They just know it bothers them.
Oh, interesting.
See, and so it would be like asking someone to explain what it is they don't like about a piece of art. And they go, well, it's where that blue, I think it's the color blue that you used when you had the sky meet the mountain. It's like, they don't know what they're talking about. All they know is the part of the painting where the mountain meets the sky isn't working for them.
Yeah.
That's all we need to know. We know how to do the craft and change it. We just want to know, how are you feeling? So we usually just, like, did you like whatever, in a piece of paper we might say, is there anything you didn't like?
And that's enough feedback for you.
All we usually say is comments. Most of the feedback we're getting by sitting in the audience with them while they're watching it, and we can all collectively come together and say, you know what, that moment didn't work. I felt that after she said that, it dragged. Or I heard a moan after she left the room and we wanted them to be excited about her leaving. Things like that you get, and then you got to come back and say, wait, we got to fix that.
And you can't tell those moments because you're so close to it?
Right. It's just way too close.
Yeah.
You know, you just, it's now you've edited and edited and edited. You know, you just don't know. You know, and so that's what you learn from showing it to an audience.
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, that's not a technique that I've really thought too much about. Is just like what you're saying. People don't totally know how to articulate what you should do, but just their emotions
can
be
great. It's
just
a reaction.
Yeah,
you know, that's all you're looking for, because often they'll say something that is the wrong. They're not saying what they mean. I hate this person. What they don't know is you're supposed to. But what do they mean by when they're saying they hate them? Is there a place where we went too far that they already hated them? Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know what they mean.
Yeah.
You just have to interpret it. Mm-hmm. You know, and cinema's funny. All you do is just change one little thing and the whole movie ripples through differently.
Yeah.
It's very little changes the balance of a movie. It's amazing. It's called Eisensteiny, we call it. You know, it's everything that comes before and after an individual cut severely affects the whole nature of the film. So it's very, you know, oh yeah, you can take one cut and flip-flop it. It'll change the intent of a scene.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Every
so.
Detail matters.
It's just when you get tired of the details is when you stop.
Right. All right, I think I have just a couple more questions. And the first one is, do you think the type of stories that are coming out of Hollywood these days have changed dramatically from back when you were getting inspired to come into cinema? Or?
Well, it seems like there was a blend between, at the time when I was coming up, it felt like that popular cinema had more substance, that more storytelling to it than it. Now there seems to be, it's just too much of the same, not much originality.
Why do you think that is?
It's profit driven. It really is. I mean, it's just that when I look at a slate of movies that are coming out, they're all either Marvel comic driven, they're sequel driven. So people are just trying, you know, the bottom line, I guess the corporate structure of things has put a weight on these studios to deliver, you know, profitable films. And the only thing they can rely on is what's been profitable to now. Just keep doing it until people get tired of it. And people haven't gotten tired of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it seemed like in those days, or back then, not to say, look, well, I was going to say back then there was more variety of originality that was equally successful, and seems less so now to me. I don't know if it's true or not. Seems like it to me. So I was happy I came up at the time I did, because there seemed to be a lot of stimulating, like what I call first run movies that, you know, you like, I wanted to work on Easy Rider, or I wanted to work, I mean, popular movies, you know. I actually wanted to work on a Star Wars movie. I liked Back to the Future. I thought it was a great idea.
Yeah.
You know, I understand why I wanted to make a sequel, you know. Mm-hmm. Hey, I was thrilled to see Godfather Part II. I got to see two of my favorite movies of all time. I got to see an original and a sequel that were like, possibly two of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
You know, that one was a sequel of the other. Mm-hmm. But it's not like one blanket rule, but at the same time,
that's how you feel things are going.
Yeah, it's how I feel things are going.
Yeah. What do you think movies, and maybe I'll specify not documentaries, the movies that you do these days. What do you think that form can do that like no other storytelling form can? Or what do you think like makes it unique and powerful in a way that other art forms or other storytelling forms can't quite do?
Well, you know, in cinema, you're able to transport people into both emotional and visual worlds that, say, you can't do necessarily, say on stage. You're thinking of live theater in relation to, you know, this. you know, movies. It's a collective experience, which is unique, where people gather around, you know, this storytelling as an audience and as a clan of people, where I think when you share emotions together, they heighten them and makes it sort of a very unique experience. You know, you think of a lot of art being very solitary, you know, reading, art appreciation, like fine art appreciation, or you do get the collective experience in a theater, but the imagery is limited, you know, where you transport yourself like you do in cinema. And you have a greater ability to move through time in cinema. And also just the cinematic form of bringing you that much closer to the performers makes it a more intimate experience. You know, when you're on stage, they're projecting out to you in the 50th row, and here you're in the row and their face is right, you know, that cinematic special effect of the close-up is right in your face, you know. So I think it's just that the intimacy of it, the pace, the ability to transport you, and then just this collective, you know, experience has been around since probably sitting around a campfire and being told a story in a group environment has been around through the ages. And this is our modern form of that, which makes it, in a sense, unique to our time, but not unique to storytelling. So I think that's why it's a great art form.
And if there were people out there who are in college or their recent graduates who are looking to jump on the path, kind of like you did when you left Berkeley, aspiring filmmakers, what advice do you have to them?
You know, like a hotbed of fresh ideas. So not only are fresh storytelling ideas are going to come from these young people who are now studying cinema and shrugging or deciding, now, okay, I get that as a foundation for cinema, but now I want to try something new. But now you're with a bunch of people who all want to try something new. So you're learning not only the art form historically, but you're learning new ways to move the art form into new places and areas. And if you're not in film school, where do you do that? How do you find this collective of people who are inspired and excited and trying things out and learning about cinema as an art form? So I think film school, I didn't go to film school, so I missed that. A lot of the people that went to USC film school, like Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis, went to SC. They wrote Back to the Future together. They wrote I Want to Hold Your Hand. These are movies before I was with him as a partner, and I started on Roger Rabbit. They, not to say it's for everyone, but, you know, Lucas went to, who I also worked with, you know, went to USC Film School. And he also came away with contemporaries who he related to over the years and relied on to come and bounce ideas off of. Yes. Because he trusted them as colleagues in school. I form those relationships working. So when I want to bounce ideas off of people, it's the people I met along the way who I became trusted friends with, like the Frank Marshalls or Kathy Kennedy or even a Steven, and certainly Bob Zemeckis. You know, Lucas, I'm still in touch with. You know, the people that I met along the way.
Yeah.
So I would say either you'd go that route, or you try to surround yourself or become part of a family of filmmakers. Like, say you love what J.J. Abrams does, or you love what Spielberg does, or whoever does. You try to just find a place in their world to see how they actually work and learn from them, because they're the ones, if you could choose a mentor in the world, choose a mentor, or just an environment of film. You like that Netflix is putting out 100 frigging movies a year. Why can't I get on one of them? And learn from that experience how they're making these economical you know, widely original content, you know, and they have no intention of stopping. I mean, this is a very well-funded, you know, Amazon and Netflix. These guys are going to be making product. They want to feed the product mill. So there's not enough talent, meaning enough people who know how to do this out there to keep up with them. There's got to be places to start and learn. Go there and do what I did. If it's not in sound, learn about camera. If it's not camera, go learn about editing. Go learn something. And all it does is it gives you an avenue to then, and a place where you're in place to see, I may not like this, but I see what I do like. And then pursue that.
Great advice.
That's about it.
Yeah.
That's all you can do.
Anything else we should touch on? What do you think?
No, I think lunch is a good thing to touch on.
Thank you for your time. And Welcome to Marwen is out
December 21st.
December 21st.
It opens in cinemas around the country, and I'm not sure internationally yet, but it'll be a good antidote to the holiday treats.
Yes, and for those listening, I do want to mention I am an extra in the movie.
Welcome to Marwen. Look carefully in the gallery at the end of the movie, and you might see this podcaster.
Thank you, Steve. Okay. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
All right.
Thank you to everyone for tuning in for episode 2 of the Austin Meyer podcast. I hope you enjoyed Steve's wisdom as much as I did. You know, as someone who is at the beginning of my own journey in film, I found it really inspiring to hear about Steve's drive and dedication when his career was just starting out. You know, he created opportunities for himself, and then when he got opportunities, he didn't let them slip away. He took advantage of them. And I'm really hoping to do the same thing moving forward. So that was really awesome to hear. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please share it with a friend or tell a family member or screenshot your phone and post it to your Insta story. Every little bit helps. Rate, subscribe, do the review on iTunes, all that kind of stuff. You know how it goes. And what do you think of the show so far? 2 episodes in, how are we doing? Hit me up on social media at Austin Meyer Films on Instagram, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. Let me know what you want to hear more of. This is a work in progress. It's a journey. I'm learning as I go, trying to get better, doing these interviews. And the only way I can really improve is from hearing from you all. What can I do better? What do you want to hear more of? So please hit me up. Okay, that's it for me. That's it for episode 2. I love you all. Now go out and tell some stories.